Good afternoon, everybody. I'm very glad to see you here. I'd like to say a special hello to people who are coming in and watching us virtually. Very glad to be here today with what I think is going to be a fairly unusual panel and talking about some what I think are some emerging topics that I'm hoping that you will help us explore this together. My name is Ellen Wagner. I'm with WCET, the Wichita Cooperative for Educational Technologies. I am joined by my colleagues, members of WCET, Dr. Deborah Everhart, Dr. Fred Hurst, and Dr. Karen Solomon. We have convened a panel that is going to be talking about breakthroughs. The title, From Badges to Breakthroughs, is exploring a topic of what we think is going to be considerable interest, looking at what are we going to do with some of these new models that force us outside the box known as the course. So what I'd like to do is to just go over a couple of things you can expect from the session. We're here to share perspectives and experiences from people who are dealing with some of these breakthrough models from very, very different perspectives. One of them being from our accrediting agency, one from the Academic Affairs Office, and one from academics as well as from the corporate perspective. So we've tried to cover as many of the dimensions of the higher ed ecosystem as we can to talk about what these new emerging models are going to be looking like. As you had seen in the description, we are talking about a number of different things: MOOCs, direct assessments, personalized learning, and badges. And looking at what we as practitioners are going to need to be thinking about as we find ourselves increasingly pushed away from the idea of having everything scheduled, say, three times a week for 50 minutes on a semester-by-semester basis. So just really quickly to set the stage, what I'd like to do is to just go over a couple of things that I think many of us talk about quite a bit, but it's always good to make sure we have leveled the playing field, you know, we're all talking about the same things. We know that student populations of all ages, whether they are the traditional 18 to 22-year-old or the adult returning student, are all expecting that our learning is going to be as flexible and as multidimensional as we find the rest of our lives. And looking to ways in which we can make education wrap around what our lives are doing, not necessarily the other way around. We're also finding that with the elite institutions discovering these things called MOOCs, that for many of us who have been working in distributed learning for some time, that the fact that we are now finding people who normally would not have looked at technology-mediated learning in the same ways have come to the table and are bringing amazing new energies to this conversation. We also understand that while these new models are emerging, that the question of whether or not people are getting the value for their education investment continues to be asked increasingly more loudly as time goes on. And I think everyone here understands that this ticking time bomb of student debt means that as we start considering these new models, our responsibility is to make sure that we are talking about things that, in fact, are within the reach of the constituencies that we hope to reach. Very quickly, the idea of looking toward alternative credentials has certainly been catching fire. One quick quote from Thomas Friedman: the idea that alternative credentialing has the potential to lift more people out of poverty is a fairly compelling value proposition, a fairly compelling hypothesis for us. Looking at ways that alternative credentials can really shift the dynamic in our learning to engage people in very different ways. We all know that this is starting to emerge, and clearly when we hear these calls coming to us from outside of education, those of us within the academy and serving the academy are finding ourselves needing to pay a lot more attention. So quickly, the things that we had identified in some of these alternative models, MOOCs. It's hard to walk around the EDUCAUSE conference without encountering MOOCs, isn't it? The idea, as we mentioned, personalized learning, competency-based learning, or the direct assessments of competencies, and then really looking at what badges are going to start doing to shift this conversation. So quickly, three main arenas of opportunity: evaluating and awarding credit for student learning, however it has been acquired, certainly an opportunity; looking at growing numbers of institutions where we're looking at degrees and certificates awarded on courses and credits are also now being augmented and, in fact, in some places, even supplanted, if you will, by prior learning assessments. Community service, looking at student portfolios, looking at what people can actually do with the learning that they are experiencing, and looking at ways that we can grow those networks. We're also looking at ways to come up with alternative credentials that recognize demonstrated, validated competencies that will be recognized outside of the environment in which they are being earned. In some vocational areas, looking at learning where the verified ability to perform on the job, I think one of my favorite quotes comes from Peter Smith from Kaplan, who has talked about how many of us in education are worried about making sure students are ready to graduate. But the big challenge for so many of us is making sure that our students are also ready to go to work. And so for many of us, trying to move into arenas where we in education really didn't have to do so much worrying about the vocational side, it's almost impossible for us to avoid that. Finally, looking at things like badges. We're going to hear a lot about badges, these discrete little packages that help to demonstrate achievement or give people opportunities for recognition in ways that we haven't done it before. We're discovering that there is great hunger, the idea of earning a badge. Who among us here hasn't been finding themselves in some of their social media lives working on your badges? I'm not able to see very easily because of the lights, but I would ask you to raise your hands. How many of you have found yourself going out and earning a badge as you have been completing an assignment, playing with games with some of your friends on the internet? Even working within your Facebook, your social media environments. The idea of completing a task and getting an award for that completion. It doesn't matter one's age. I think the idea of earning those badges is compelling just because of the motivation of having something to show for what it is that we've been doing. So with that setup, one thing I would like to do, we are going to have people who are coming in, as we said, who are joining us virtually. And there may be some of you that I will tell you that because we can't really see hands, if you have questions as you are sitting in your seat, I would encourage you to use the hashtag EDU13. I'm going to be trying to monitor some of these tweets from my little mobile phone here. So if you find that I'm not getting to your question, I've included my own personal Twitter tag here. But I think what will probably work as well for many is if you do have questions is to hold them, and I would ask you to please go to one of the microphones so that we can get the question recorded as part of the web experience so that everybody can hear what we're talking about. So I do want to take a little bit, just a one slide discussion of MOOCs. We included this in the session description when we submitted, realizing that this would be part of our conversation, but really looking at the program with so many MOOC sessions, we don't really want to use the time here to talk too much about MOOCs. But I would be remiss if I did not point you to some resources that we at WCET have been looking at. Actually, our simple guide for navigating the MOOC muddle by Mike Garn and Luke Dowden. Mike and Luke, of course, being our MOOCs. We have been working with so many of the members of WCET to not so much look at the research questions as it is what do we as practitioners need to think about if we expect to implement well. And so what I would say to you is that as we have been compiling resources, we at WCET have been posting many of these. I'm pointing to one in particular which will give you a checklist. But with that, what I'd like to do is to not spend that much time on MOOCs today, but to allow Dr. Fred Hurst to start talking to us about personalized learning. And so what I would do is to, what we're going to do is to let each one of our presenters take a bit of time to address you directly, and they will each have slides. So we're going to be taking turns here at the podium. And once we've had a chance for everybody to do their presentations, we will be turning this back into a question and answer conversation among ourselves. We will be watching Christy, our moderator, who is going to help us with questions coming in from the field. So if you have questions, please make sure that you post them, and we will be able to respond. And if you do have questions here in the room, please make sure that you come up to the microphone and let us know. So with that, Dr. Hurst.
Thanks, Ellen. Let's see. You know, this is EDUCAUSE, so I had to use this particular quote, change is good, you go first. Of course, Dilbert. And, you know, I think that that's the way a lot of people feel about change in higher education. It's good to see someone go first, and we've tried to do that. So What I'm going to do is very quickly walk through our personalized learning initiative. And this is our standard one-line description of personalized learning. It enables motivated students. It's not designed for an 18-year-old who is trying to explore what they want to do in their life. It's primarily designed for adult students who have experience in the workforce and capabilities probably beyond an 18-year-old. It was important that it lead to a high-quality degree, that we not in any way change the quality of what we're offering because we're doing it in this new way. It was important for it to be more efficient, both for the student and for the university, and then finally at a lower cost to the university and the student as well. And the way we do that is by customizing the coursework to fit each student's individual learning styles. And some of you out there might be saying there's no such thing as a learning style, there's questions there. And what we're really trying to say there is that that people learn in different ways, and we want to be able to accommodate that. And then finally, it's very important from our perspective to honor students' prior knowledge. Those of you who are out there can, I'm sure, still remember being in a course in college, especially if you were an adult student, and thinking, I could teach this class, you know, that doesn't make any sense really for us to have students who have a high level of capability in an area sit through a course, a full semester long course that they don't need to. So what is it? The student experience is a self-paced online adaptive learning sort of approach. The idea is that every student is different. One of the things that I like to talk about is the current education system is a lot like an assembly line. We assume everyone is the same coming into a course. We make them sit through 16 weeks of instruction, whether they need to do that, and hopefully they learn something. Even if they didn't learn something, they often pass on through that class with a C, and not having learned what they really need to. One of the important parts is that the faculty play a different role. We've unbundled the faculty role in this, and there are mentor faculty who are responsible for working with the student to ensure that they are successful in the program, and that could be as discipline tutoring, or it could be as simple as working about the talking with the student about the balance between work, their life in general, and the study that they need to do. So they start with a readiness assessment, and that readiness assessment tells us two things. One is that the student is well suited to this sort of an approach, that they can work in a self-paced environment, that they're motivated. And the other part is whether or not they have the capabilities that they need in order to be successful. So if they don't, let's take a real concrete example. If in the readiness assessment we find that they don't understand probability, and probability is important for their ability to be successful, what we would do is not put them into a math course that included probability. We would give them a module on probability and have them work through that before they start the program. The curriculum is interdisciplinary and prescribed. There are no electives. We talked a lot about this, but you know, in order to really make sure that it's a coherent degree, most of what we offer in most of our universities and colleges, we always talk about coherency of curriculum. There really isn't much from my perspective. You take one of these, you take one of those. There are some required courses, but so we decided to make it prescriptive. And for every concept, this is a very important part of personalized learning. There are multiple modalities for the student to learn that concept. So it could be a video documentary, it could be, of course, a textbook, but it could be a game, a simulation, and they, can work through those. And then finally, there are assessments. There's a pre-assessment that the student takes before they even start the course. And if the student is able to test out of part of the course by taking that pre-assessment, think of it as the final exam before you start the course, they can test out of part of the course or even the entire course before they even start. They have interim feedback, and then at the end they take a post-assessment. If they don't get 86% or better, they don't pass out of the class. They also don't fail the class. They learn something in that time period. They go back into the class, and they study what they need to be successful in passing the class. So we developed the degree programs in 6 months. They're Small Business Administration, Computer Information Technology, and Liberal Arts. There's a lead faculty for each degree, and what the lead faculty have only two responsibilities. They don't teach the class. They design the class in the first place and implement it, and then they're responsible for the total quality management of that course going forward. So they watch the students going through, and if a student is having trouble with a concept, they will find new modalities that are more effective in getting the students through that particular program. The student can start any day of the year. It's self-paced. Why not? And we're on a subscription model like Netflix, $2,500 per 6 months. That's all inclusive, all fees, materials, texts, and it's an all-you-can-eat sort of approach, meaning you can take as many courses as you can in that 6 months, or partial courses, and it's still the same cost. It isn't based on credit hour in terms of costing. And there are two student records. One is a traditional transcript, and the other is a competency report. The traditional transcript allows a student to transfer to another degree program easily, and the competency report is designed for employers. So we were approved by the Higher Learning Commission. Karen will talk some about the accreditor role here in a few minutes. On May 21st, we reached understanding with the U.S. Department of Education to offer Title IV financial aid in August. We have about 100 students enrolled with over 1,200 prospects, and our goal is 500 students in the first year, 8,005. And we will be introducing new programs soon. Karen Solomon.
Thank you, Fred. Well, I'm going to talk a bit this afternoon about the process that we actually utilized at the Higher Learning Commission to approve not only Northern Arizona University but three other institutions for direct assessment. We've had many institutions offering competency-based credits over the years, but this is a new move into direct assessment. We're going to talk a little bit about that. There is actually federal regulation and definitions that apply to direct assessment. Western Governors University has been awarding degrees based on competency for many years, but they've always converted back into credit hours, and they've bundled those competencies into credit hours. Direct assessment separates that, so that students can earn a degree by fulfilling, mastering a series of competencies. Now, there's a caveat that we still expect our institutions to go back and work to credit hour equivalencies so that the institutions can do the transcripting that Fred just noted. Federal financial aid is not eligible for students' previous work or if they immediately test out of competencies. It's the time that they're actually working on once they enroll and then begin working on new competencies. And there are three different points of review for many of our institutions. Direct assessment is new for the United States. There have been five institutions awarded approval for direct assessment in the country within the last few months, and they're the first five in the nation. So some of our states are scrambling, trying to figure out how they're going to evaluate institutions and whether they can be approved to offer direct assessment. Accrediting agencies, including our office, are building processes to be able to evaluate direct assessment and determine whether the institution has a sufficient preparation. And then after gaining accreditation or accreditor's approval, the institution then needs to step to the U.S. Department of Education and gain approval from that entity also. So there are several phases of review that are different for some of our institutions that have been able to grow and develop new programs without a great deal of oversight because they've had experience in growing traditional programs. This is a new phase, and I expect for a while many of our institutions will be going through this review process. We built an application specifically for direct assessment, and I'm going to talk about some of the general areas of what we're looking for when an institution works for that application. First of all, that there is a purpose and philosophy with clearly defined goals for this direct assessment, and that there's a framework that's been developed for the programs, and that there's a structure and a coherence to the program. As previously stated, it is prescribed step-by-step process that students go through in gaining mastery. So there is truly a beginning, middle, and an end. Students aren't sort of cafeteria-style selecting courses or competencies as they choose. There is a prescribed way of working. And the competencies should not only be individual units, but they should build to a unified body of knowledge. And students will be demonstrating this through a variety of different portfolios, embedded tests, quizzes, presentations, externships, internships, a wide range of different activities that sort of build to that culmination of that degree. We're expecting that institutions have academic policies related to these students that are involved in direct assessment. And this is where, for some of our institutions, it becomes really tricky to start to think about, what is student eligibility? What is satisfactory academic progress? When is a student officially withdrawn or taking a leave of absence from this program? Thinking about what the admissions requirements would be. So for some of our institutions, this is an area where they've really had to dig in and do some more work. It wasn't just, let's build this really interesting program and figure out what the competencies are, but also figuring out how we're going to manage this student population. Trying to identify how you explain these competencies to students that are clearly articulated so they truly understand what they're enrolling in. And then also offering different types, potentially, of support services than you would for your traditional student population. These are self-paced students. And that's unusual for many personnel at the institution to think about. There's no term or semester here. There's not a stop and a start. Students can be working nonstop for 6 weeks or 6 months, or they could slow down and they could expand in different ways. They may be asking for different types of services at odd points in time of which the personnel at the institution aren't familiar with. So our institutions are thinking about, how do we engage across our entire institution, everybody that will be touched by these students, and figure out whether we have appropriate services for the students. And also, there's an expectation in these programs that students aren't siloed and learning on their own, that there are mechanisms for peer engagement throughout the entire process, whether that's chat rooms or discussion groups or opportunity for students even to get together on a face-to-face basis. Faculty, interesting topic here. We look at sort of disaggregating the roles of faculty and having different players in some of these different roles. So there are subject matter experts that actually work to define the competencies and build that cohesive program, but they will not probably, in many situations, end up being the actual instructors. You will have also course designers, curriculum designers that are helping to flesh out the program from that expectation. And that there will be a curation of public and open sources that students will be able to reference as they're working on their different competencies. There are also folks that are mentors and coaches. Those are the folks that students can turn to if they're stuck, if they need a little guidance, if they've submitted their work for a competency and been told, it's not good enough. You didn't fail, as Fred mentioned, but it's not good enough to demonstrate mastery. And so these coaches and mentors can assist the students in that phase of the process. And then there's an expectation of content assessors, those that will really take a look at the student work, determine whether it is sufficient and whether it demonstrates mastery or not. What makes more challenging than ever before is assessment of student learning. This is where our institutions really need to be able to understand what they expect in terms of documentation of student learning. It's not that the student has shown up for 16 weeks, sat in the chair, and part of that grade was based on attendance or participation in class. This is truly about, has the student demonstrated the learning that is expected, and how is the institution tracking that learning? Where do you identify that there are competencies where students seem to stumble more, or they move through very quickly? Where are there some disconnects as you grow from competency to competency? So there's a constant analysis of student learning going on and an expectation that the institution will work to improve this program just in the way that they would a typical credit hour-based program. That there are evaluation and improvement systems, not just for student learning, but we're expecting our institutions not only launch direct assessment, but they're constantly evaluating all the various aspects, not just the competencies, but the support services, the types of students that are enrolled, the degree to time at which it takes, or the length of time to which it takes students to actually earn the competency. So there are a variety of different expectations that our institutions are constantly culling through that information. Our expectation is our institutions also have to think about billing in Title IV, another area that's actually taken quite a bit of work by some of our institutions to think about, when do you refund tuition to students? Or when do you have to calculate and refund aid back to the U.S. Department of Education? A couple more areas that our institutions said, wow, we need to really rework some of our formulas and processes so that we can move forward quickly on this. Our expectation, though, is that our institutions, even though it's direct assessment, still build credit hour equivalencies, because transcripting here is one of the most important aspects of earning this degree. Students may go on to another institution. They decide to transfer out of the program. They may go on for an advanced degree at another point in time. So it will be important that our institutions that may be receiving these students have the information that they need to make an informed judgment of whether to transfer credits in. And that also has taken some time for institutions to be able to work through that credit hour equivalency component. And as previously mentioned, that there is sort of an explanation of what a competency transcript would look like. Or what it details, and so that when if a student hands that competency transcript to an employer, per se, that employer can understand what a competency-based degree is and what competencies have been earned and things like that. It's going to be a challenge, I think, for some of our institutions to be able to develop that clear language that's understood by their external constituents. I think they can talk it well internally, but that external explanation is going to be probably one of the areas that takes the most time and effort for many of our folks. And lastly, institutions, many are working with contractual partners. These are not other accredited institutions, but they are other entities that are providing significant support, maybe assisting with curricular design and things like that. Quite a few issues that our institutions have had to provide information on as they've actually made the application for direct assessment. Our direct assessment application will actually be up on our website next week for institutions that are interested in completing that application and moving through the process. It's a detailed application. We've tried to make an application that's also informative and helps institutions think about what they need to consider as they're working towards direct assessment.
So that's really great segue, by the way, to what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to start with the assumption that most of the people in this audience understand, they have a basic understanding of badges, that they provide verifiable evidence of learning, that they're portable, and they can be used in a variety of contexts, job seeking and letting badge holders use their badges to show their achievements. So I'm going to provide some explanation of how badges attain value and currency in a balanced ecosystem of stakeholders. So Blackboard, WCET, Mozilla, and Sage Road have been working together to help improve the exchange value of badges as they're used between educational institutions, learners, and employers. We're focused specifically on that space. And we've collaborated on a MOOC, which is Badges, New Currency for Professional Development. We're using the MOOC in a non-course way. It's really a massive open online community, and it's a framework for collaboration. The heart of this community is a set of resources about badges, and these resources are all available for reuse under a Creative Commons license. This is where you'll find them. And this is also where you can go to enroll in the course and learn much more about what I'm going to go through quickly today. So the materials provide scaffolding for the participants in this MOOC to learn more about how badge ecosystems work, including a series of challenge assignments that we've developed that walk people through building badge systems. And this isn't about the technology of badge systems, but more importantly, it's about understanding the stakeholders and the processes that make badge systems effective. The materials are built around the metaphor of currency system, how value is established, validated, and exchanged. So, for example, we know that courses, credits, credentials, these are all well-understood currency systems in our educational ecosystems. So how do we understand what it takes for badges to achieve that kind of currency? To build this understanding, we analyze how badges work in an ecosystem of interrelated and interdependent stakeholders. The ecosystem analysis can be adapted to a lot of different types of institutions, different goals for badge implementation, but these are the primary stakeholders we cover in this analysis, and I'll walk through these. So this is the ecosystem diagram that we use in a lot of ways in the materials for providing a framework for understanding how these things balance out. And at the heart of the ecosystem is the learner, particularly as a learner becomes the person who needs to use their achievements when they go out and become a job seeker. Because job seekers are often challenged when they try to represent the value of their achievements and persuade prospective employers that they have the competencies, the attributes that employer is seeking. And badges can help them tell that story in some very concrete ways. We've analyzed, for example, the challenges faced by veterans returning to the workforce, and there are badge systems that are designed to help them package and represent their military experience directly geared toward employers. So, did I miss the slide? Here we go, sorry. I think I skipped ahead a couple, I'm sorry. Learners, learning providers. So the job seekers may be getting their job-related skills and competencies through some form of education. And here we're referring to learning providers of all descriptions. So this could be colleges and universities, community colleges, professional education, as well as MOOCs and other open educational resources. And the learners will use them to fill gaps and to gain new knowledge and skills. And as those competencies are acquired, the badges can be awarded by the learning providers to reflect those abilities. So we've analyzed, for example, not only the role of traditional learning providers, but also training organizations, learning communities, and innovative competency-based learning programs like the ones we're hearing about here today. So, but before the badge awards are actually made, the skills that those badges represent need to be verified. And the verification happens typically in our environment through assessment. What that means is that the badges are tied to assessment, not to learning. The badges don't care where or how the competencies were acquired or what the curriculum the learner went through, or maybe they didn't go through any formal curriculum. So as a consequence of this, assessment can be decoupled from learning programs, and this becomes a really valuable point when you think about how these ecosystems work. And it leads to new opportunities in the value exchange system with regard to the relationship between learners, learning providers, and assessors. We've analyzed different types of assessment, including prior learning assessment, and how learner self-assessment can be verified. Employers have specific requirements about the attributes and competencies they value among their employees, and these are reflected in their job descriptions, new hire requisitions, performance reviews, etc. And badges can be the method for communicating these specific employer requirements. And so we've analyzed, for example, how badges can help address the skills gap that currently plagues employers. And it leads to many, something like 3 million in the U.S. unfilled positions currently because of the skills gap. It's often been difficult for employers to determine what the job seeker says on an application or a resume is true. But with the metadata associated with the badge and authentication technology, employers actually have means to authenticate the job seekers who present badges to substantiate their assertions of qualification are, in fact, the people who earned the badges. The competencies that are called out by employers often reflect regulations, industry standards, best practices as articulated by standards organizations. And these standards bodies get input from academic research, from employers, evolving best practices, and in turn, the standards bodies provide guidance and in some cases governance over business practices. The competencies defined by standards organizations inform and support a healthy ecosystem. That's why we diagram them here in sort of a bridging way. And when badges are tied to assessments that are themselves tied to industry standards and best practices, the likelihood of finding the right match between a job seeker and an employer is greatly improved. And learning providers are in a better position to offer learning programs that align with employer requirements. So we've analyzed, for example, National Trade Organization's efforts to articulate clear sets of competencies, map those to badge frameworks, and the use of those badge frameworks in that context, in that bridging way, between the learning providers, the assessors, and the employers. Learning providers have traditionally relied on academic accreditation and in some cases simply reputation as validation of the value of their targeted learning outcomes. Because badges are agnostic to the mode of learning that learners use to gain these competencies, learning providers are identifying new ways to engage learners and personalize their learning paths. But as they do, they need to work within accreditation and regulatory frameworks. This emphasizes the need for clear, transparent validation of learning providers' new methodologies because without them, the value of the badges is questionable. It upsets the balance of the ecosystem. So we've analyzed, for example, the impact of accreditation changes on opening up flexible opportunities that include badges in well-validated learning systems. So I'll close where I started by saying that there's enormous potential for badges as a new currency, and we encourage everyone to use a lot of the resources that we've provided and participate in the community. We're figuring out how we can work together on building these kinds of well-balanced ecosystems where the value of the currency is clear and useful to all of the stakeholders.
Well, as you can see, we have tried to provide you with a snapshot from a number of different perspectives here that that can help start us thinking about what we're going to have to do to start accommodating things. And what I get to do right now is to ask the panel a couple of questions. What I'd like to do is to remind you all who are watching us on the internet to please send in your questions. We'll be able to pick those up. I want to thank those of you who have been tweeting some questions. We've been trying to catch those, and luckily our panelists anticipated where you were going, so that was great. And what I get to do right now is to ask my colleagues a couple of questions, and to make this more conversational, I'm just going to put my three questions up on the screen right now. So basically they are this, and I do want to make sure that when I talk to the panelists that when I talk about their breakthrough innovation, it's not so much that they invented what they are talking about here on the panel. I want to make sure that this is very clear. Each person here took a particular innovation that they wanted to focus on, and so in that context, these questions are more about the topic about which you were just speaking. So they're really the basic things. Where do you see the biggest opportunity for your breakthrough? You've talked some about that already. Secondly, what do you see as the biggest possible hurdle? One, the possible is in parens because sometimes we anticipate what the problems might be and they're not actually there. So in this particular case, thinking about if people were going to move ahead, if you were going to tell people what you have learned, what would that be? And I think that the final thing is, when people break here in just about 10 minutes, what's the one thing you want them to remember about what you said today? And I think everybody has a microphone. So what I'm going to do is to just invite you all to just speak up and share what's on your mind. Karen, why don't you go first?
I'll go first. That way, I won't have to figure out if somebody else says something that I was going to say.
There you go.
If I can figure out another answer. I think the direct assessment has the opportunity to touch a lot of adult learners that have many competencies that they have already demonstrated in their professional life and their personal life, and be able to be recognized for that, and then also to learn some more in order to earn a degree and improve employment employment opportunities and things like that. The biggest hurdle I see is the ability to have that internal external conversation, because I don't know how direct assessment will translate out of the academy into the broader public sphere. The other hurdle, as I think, is that we don't have consensus on what is mastery. We have, if I look across three institutions, Northern Arizona at competencies at 86%, another institution's at 70%, and another institution's at 100%. So it once again starts to muddy the water as far as that goes. And the last question, what do you want people to remember about what's been presented? That I think accreditation is evolving as a type of work that we do, and looking at some of the emerging ways that people are being educated and trying to find processes and policies that we can help our institutions do that, but still complete a quality review.
Oh, that's great, Karen. Thank you. Fred, I'm going to call on you next.
Okay, great. The biggest opportunity, I think, for competency-based programs is the ability to finally address the needs of students in a way that is personalized to each of their past experiences and what they really need from the educational experience. In the past, it was a one-size-fits-all sort of situation. I think the biggest possible hurdle is that it's enough different that people, including students and employers, are thinking, you know, how does this work? Is it really quality? Is it really succeeding in what it says it's going to do? And then I think the final thing about what has been presented, I think that that from my perspective, that competency-based education is the future of education, I think, at all levels. We're finally at a point where the technology and the pedagogy and the understanding of what we're trying to accomplish, we can push it forward at the K-12 level, even at the professional development level, I believe, to be the model for the future.
That's great, Fred. And Deb,
yeah,
please.
I think, am I turned on? Yeah. I think that's a good segue to what I would say about the opportunity of badges, because you use the phrase competency-based education. I've been using the phrase competency-based learning, because learning is, you know, across that full spectrum. It's inside of school, it's outside of school, it's at home, it's at work, it's lifelong learning, right? And so competency-based education as a set of frameworks that helps us achieve that within regulatory frameworks, public funding, federal financial aid, how that translates from one institution to another and one degree program to another. That's all really important in terms of how we define competency-based education programs. But for me, one of the really great things about badges is that they really do unleash learning and can fire incredible enthusiasm in audiences of all ages. A lot of the badging work that's been done to date is for youth, particularly aimed at junior high and high school students who have just gotten checked out of their traditional education programs and can get involved in after-school programs or peer learning programs or other things where they achieve badges. And it's easy to visualize that when you're thinking of, you know, a 16-year-old. But it's also something that we can all experience through our whole lives. It's like what Jane was saying earlier today about gaming, right? It gives you that adrenaline. I realized when I was putting together my remarks for this panel, I'm like, this is really dry. Because compared to what Jane was saying about, you know, gamification and what it feels like to be on a leaderboard, or what it feels like, what it literally feels like to see your badges stacking up, knowing that they're going to level up to this higher badge. This set of badges gives me the credentials I need to go do something else. That's powerful for people of all ages. So I think I would just hold my comments on the other two points, maybe take some questions from the audience.
Yeah, I'd like to do that. I'd like to encourage, if you do have questions, please come to the microphone and let us know. I'm going to ask another quick question while I'm waiting for, so I see somebody moving there. Excellent. Thank you so much.
I'm Hayao Kimura, University of Hawaii. So I have a question in terms of this validation, because as we're working with our faculty, saying, okay, we have to, if we're looking at badges and looking at competencies and validation of what they want, the first thing faculty want to do is, well, they can take a test, and if they get a score of this, then it validates that they have that skill. And I'm thinking, surely, how can we change their mindset? So is it, like, for example, how do you validate that you know safety in an auto mechanic shop? They go, take a test. Well, maybe that's not the best way to just be. Being able to regurgitate information may not be validating that they have that, they could earn the automotive safety badge. Do you have any suggestions?
I think, you know, I can start off just a little bit with it, and I would say that, you know, that assessment should be constructed in a way that really addresses the competency that you're trying to assess. And, you know, you're not going to give a multiple choice test for writing capability. For example, you're going to have students write, and in many cases, if it's a demonstration of a skill of a certain type, then you need to provide that sort of experience. In our case, we have both internships and service learning sorts of things that are requirements, and part of that is to demonstrate skills that cannot be tested by an objective test.
And I think that that's also like some of the discussions about MOOCs we're having are, how do MOOCs raise questions that, come on, we should have asked a long time ago and tried to address in terms of quality and what is legitimate assessment and whatever. And I think that the competency-based innovations do the same thing. So how can we have a much greater range of adaptable types of assessment? And so, because a lot of badge frameworks are not in a traditional educational environment, there's a lot of creativity going on there, including learners assessing other learners. So, for example, you see this a lot in gaming communities, but you also see it in coding communities, where someone has leveled up to earn a certain badge for coding, then also gets the privilege of evaluating other people who are, you know, coming up through the different levels. You can have community verification of direct assessment isn't the right phrase, but of evidence of assessment. So say, for example, it's a shop safety, and I actually videotape myself going around, handling the tools, knowing how to place them, how to put on the goggles correctly, and then other people who have achieved, you know, some certificate of safety or whatever, are other people in that community who can watch those videos and say, yes, those are the correct procedures? There are a lot of creative ways of doing this, and as we see in gaming communities, learners are remarkably eager to help one another, especially if they're proud of having gotten that achievement themselves.
I know we have about a minute. I think we have about 30 seconds left, and actually I want to turn to Karen and make sure that as Fred and Deb have been talking about some of these, I'd love to hear your response to the same question, Karen, please.
Well, what's exciting to me, I've been at the crediting agency for 10 years. We've been pushing our institutions for 21 years on assessment of student learning and being able to document student learning. And I think this is now finally the time where institutions get it, that they really are going to have to prove that they know what students learned instead of creating a plan and planning to plan and then finding data and then it didn't work. They're really going to have to be able to document it now, which I think will change across the entire institution, the ability to be able to document in a more wholesome way what students are really learning and being able to share that in a much more transparent way.
Well, I want to take a moment to thank all three of you. I mean, being able to bring the perspectives together as we have in this panel is actually, it's one of the one things that I love so much about working with my colleagues at WCET. So with that, I would invite you to please thank our panelists for their contributions. And